This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu meet to consider Middle East tensions. Bad news for Russia in the world of track and field and maybe the Olympics. Facebook gets a big new addition. An elderly musician plays for love.
It makes you feel warm and good inside because you know you have done something worthwhile and you're helping someone else. And I think this is what life is all about.
These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met in Washington Monday, trying to find ways to cope with what the U.S. leader described as a deteriorating security environment in the Middle East. The two have often had a testy relationship, and their meeting was the first in more than a year. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey about how the leaders got along and what they discussed.
We saw Netanyahu come to the United States and speak very vocally and very sharply regarding the Iran nuclear agreement. And that speech that he made before Congress at the invitation of the House Speaker, Republican John Boehner at the time, was seen as an affront and an insult to President Obama as the U.S. Tried to negotiate this Iran nuclear deal. So this is their first meeting in a year, and obviously first since that Iran nuclear agreement was reached. And people were anticipating on how this would go. Obviously, they spoke before they actually went into 2 hours of talks, but just seeing the body language when both of them spoke to the press before going into talks, Obama and Netanyahu looked on earnestly at each other as either of them spoke. They shook hands. They talked a lot about a close alliance and friendship. And just in the body language and the remarks, it was clear that they're both leaders and both countries are trying to move past these recent tensions and this discord and trying to move on to these areas of common ground.
These are two veteran politicians,
yes.
And obviously they do have some very serious issues at hand that are common to both the United States and Israel. And they were talking about these, such as trying to blunt the activities of certain groups like Islamic State and Hezbollah and other insurgent groups.
Absolutely. And going back to Iran, and President Obama was clear that, you know, he called the disagreement on the nuclear issue, on the nuclear agreement, a, quote, narrow issue. Instead, he said both countries find common ground on Iran's destabilizing activities. Prime Minister Netanyahu mentioned Hezbollah. And they obviously both talked about the deteriorating security situation in the Middle East with the Islamic State militant group in Syria. And both leaders said now more than ever is a time for even closer U.S.-Israeli intelligence and military cooperation because of the need to deter the threat of terrorism. So that was a big area of common ground. What's going on in Iraq? What's going on in Syria and the fight against the Islamic State and other militant groups? And then, of course, there's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with President Obama talking about the need to kind of lower the temperature with we saw this recent tensions, violence, and recent attacks against Israeli citizens. He talked about the need and the right and obligation of Israel to defend itself. But at the same time, he talked about the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinians. Now, President Obama did not name the two-state solution. He didn't say two-state solution, but what was interesting is that the prime minister did. The prime minister said that, you know, I want to be clear, we have not given up our hope for peace. We'll never give up the hope for peace. And Prime Minister Netanyahu says that he remains committed to a vision of peace of two states for two peoples. So that was an interesting comment coming off of what Prime Minister Netanyahu said during his campaign earlier this year, and given what we've seen in terms of actions and settlement activity. So there were some big, big areas of discussion during their more than 2 hours of talks in the Oval Office.
VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. There is growing support for the idea that the downing of the Russian airliner in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, killing all 224 aboard, may not have been an accident. Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said Monday it could be the result of a terrorist act, marking the first time a top Russian official acknowledged the militants may have caused the disaster. In Jerusalem, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said there is a high probability that militants brought the plane down with an explosive device. Israel closely monitors the Sinai for militant activity. President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron have also said the plane was possibly bombed. A member of the investigation team told Reuters the team is 90% sure the noise heard in the final second of a cockpit recording was an explosion caused by a bomb on the ill-fated Metrojet A321 that crashed more than 20 minutes after takeoff October 31st from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The Islamic State affiliate in Egypt claimed responsibility. Confirmation of that claim could be devastating to Egypt's tourism trade, already set back by recent political turmoil. Todd Curtis of the air safety website airsafe.com told International Edition's Victor Beatty, if a bomb is proven to have brought down the flight, the risk level for a similar attempt at numerous airports will have increased.
The suspicion that this airport had a situation where a bomb was placed on board the aircraft will at the very, very least call into question the security procedures for that airport. And in a broader sense, this airport is very representative of most airports around the world. It's not a major international airport like JFK or Heathrow. It is a busy airport, certainly, because it serves a fairly popular tourist destination. Typically, not something that you would associate with a politically or socially motivated bombing event, but apparently this appears to be the case, in which case there would be dozens of airports around the world at minimum that may be at risk for the same sort of violence.
Is this going to lead to a reevaluation of check on baggage or compromised employees or issues like that?
It will depend on whether or not, first, if this is determined to be a bomb, and second, what kind of bomb it was. Now, point of fact, there are weaknesses in the system because the system relies on human beings. You have to have people who are flying and operating the aircraft, people who are on board the aircraft as flight attendants, not to mention mechanics, baggage handlers, airport staff, etc. A whole community of people who are dedicated to keeping aircraft flying, any one of which who have regular intimate access to the aircraft could, if they wished, put something on board the aircraft in the form of contraband. Now, in the U.S. for decades, there has been a problem which has never been stamped out of people who are putting contraband on aircraft for financial purposes, whether it be drugs, which is the most popular kind of contraband, or money or other kinds of objects. People who are insiders to the system have consistently, at least several times a year, have been caught and prosecuted in the U.S. for putting things on aircraft that shouldn't be there. Certainly, it's not the same motivation as someone who may be doing a bombing for political purposes, but it does show the same kind of weakness. Whatever vetting process exists is not going to be perfect because people have different motivations at different phases of their lives, different phases of their careers. So it stands to reason that if you have tens or even hundreds of thousands of people involved in the aviation system as baggage handlers, as mechanics, etc., some of them, at any given time, will be vulnerable to persuasion or to other coercion to do something they shouldn't do.
With falling oil prices, flights are up. Of course, we have the holiday season coming up. Is the traveling public concerned?
Certainly, the traveling public should be concerned because the expectation when you buy a ticket to go from point A to point B, that you do so in a safe manner and, secondarily, in a timely manner. And if you have a situation where there is a clear violation of that expectation, a clear risk that has to be addressed, then it stands to reason that the average passenger would like to see that addressed, either by an airline, by a government authority, or by some other entity who will either eliminate the risk entirely, reduce the likelihood that risk ever occurs, or, at worst case, if the risk does occur, make sure that it's not as bad as it could have been if you didn't do anything.
Todd Curtis of the air safety website airsafe.com speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's political party won the first seats in what's expected to be a landslide victory in Sunday's parliamentary elections. Election officials announced Monday that the National League for Democracy had won 12 lower house seats in the main city of Yangon. The NLD later claimed to have taken 44 or 45 lower house seats in Yangon, although that figure was not immediately confirmed by election officials. Tin Sway was elected to parliament in the last free election in 1990 when the country is known as Burma, but never took office. He fled to India rather than face arrest by the military junta, lived there for 24 years, and recently immigrated to the United States. Tin Sui is still an active member of Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy. He spoke with International Edition's Peter Heinlein.
Here it is, 25 years later, another election is happening.
Yeah.
And the indications are that it's looking very good for your party, the National League for Democracy. What's to say that the same thing won't happen again?
That is the same question I have been answering by my previous voters and my people there. They are very worried about that. 1990 election results cannot recur again. And I'm also suspicious of the military authorities. But if when we are watching the news, listening to the radios and TVs, that when the results of the seats won by NLEs come in, that's worry becomes lesser and lesser. So hopefully, this time military will allow Aung San Suu Kyi's party to go ahead with according to the results of this election.
Now, Tay U, who's the chairman of the military-backed party, has basically conceded defeat in this election. Is that a positive sign to you that maybe the ruling junta is ready to cede power?
Yeah, that is really a beauty of this election. I will say this is cultural politics. Is growing to have a seat in Burmese politics. Not only that, Tay U, he is the vice chair of the USDP party, and the current parliament president, Shui Man, he also conceded. And he congratulated in written in his Facebook, it is a rival, NLE rival. That is the new culture in Burma. So it is really, really lovely.
Is this a surprise to you that they're being so magnanimous?
Yeah, it is. I didn't expect so. These two people, example of these two people, are really gentlemen and really it's a sort of real good citizens.
Have you always known that they're gentlemen, even though they're members of the ruling party, the ruling junta?
Not personally, but they want to be. They want to change their image, I think.
What does this say about the pace of change in Myanmar? Is it real? Can you feel that maybe someday it'll be a functioning democracy just like the United States and Europe?
For me, I think as a politician, I always try to be optimistic. But at the same time, I don't underestimate those military because they have been in power for 50 years and they will not yield those things quickly. So a sort of evolution style of change is happening. But it has been 50 years. I think as our leader Aung San Suu Kyi said, as the people agree on that, now Burma needs a real change.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope it's a golden opportunity for that real change to come about.
Tin Sui is a former member of Burma's parliament, elected in 1990, and an active member of the National League for Democracy. He spoke with International Edition's Peter Heinlein. Coming up, Facebook adds a president. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
They keep hot things hot and cold things cold, but styrofoam ends up in the trash by the billions, and it's not always recycled, at least not by humans. It seems worms, though, mealworms are crazy about the stuff. Weimin Wu at Stanford University spoke via Skype. He co-authored a study on the findings that could help solve the global plastic pollution problem.
About 47% is styrofoam was digested and converted into CO2.
In the lab, 100 mealworms consumed about 39 milligrams of styrofoam a day.
After they eat styrofoam, even the mealworm discharges the fecula. 24 hours.
The worm excretion is biodegradable, but it would take a lot of worms to digest even just one cup. Wu says the idea is to identify the bacteria in the mealworm's gut, which would help researchers develop enzymes to break down polymers. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The World Anti-Doping Agency released a bombshell report recommending that track and field's governing body suspend Russia from competition. An investigation claims that Russia is, in effect, running a state-sponsored doping program. Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London spoke with International Edition's Ira Melman about the report's findings and their implications.
This is a commission set up by the World Anti-Doping Agency, really in the wake of a documentary that was shown on German television earlier this year, making specific allegations about the Russian anti-doping agency and about its complicity in the doping of Russian athletes and indeed in the with the complicity of the International Athletics Federation, the IAAF, in that doping. And it said that effectively the results of the London 2012 Olympics were sabotaged because both of those bodies failed to pick up on any of the doping allegations against questionable Russian athletes. And this commission has painted is one of what the head of the commission called state-sponsored doping, effectively, by the Russian authorities. And they've called for the immediate suspension of Russia from athletics until their anti-doping agencies meet the standards that are required. But I think this has taken the entire world of sport by surprise.
Now, this could possibly ban Russia from the upcoming Olympics. Is that correct?
Theoretically, although these are only recommendations given by the World Anti-Doping Agency Commission, they have to be taken up by the World Anti-Doping Agency itself, although it's very likely that that will happen. Russia, of course, has defended its actions. It's denied any kind of systematic or complicity in that doping, and it's called for a discussion of these allegations at the next meeting of the IAAF later this month. But if Russia is suspended because of these allegations, because of these accusations, and if the relevant authorities, the World Anti-Doping Agency, isn't satisfied that it's Russia's own anti-doping agencies are up to scratch in time for those next Olympics, then yes, indeed, it could see them suspended from taking part.
Well, just how much power beyond the recommendation? You've just touched on this, but how much weight does this carry with the rest of the world's sports administration?
I think it carries a lot of weight. It was an independent board, an independent commission set up by the WADA WADA to look into these allegations. It contains the board is made up of independent sports lawyers who have looked into this. They've taken testimony from former Russian athletes. They've got different evidence, including on-camera, hidden camera footage of some other Russian athletes where they admit to doping, and that includes gold medal winners at the London Olympics. There are further allegations as well of the IAAF being embroiled into this, allegations that they, in effect, extorted money from Russian athletes in return for giving them a clean bill, if you like. So when their test results came up positive, they were approached by senior members of the IAAF who said to them, if you don't give us in the region of $400,000 to $500,000, we will reveal your positive test. And the allegations suggest that that money was forthcoming and those tests were hidden from public view.
Now, Interpol has already announced that it is taking an investigation, I believe they said, worldwide. How likely is this to spread, perhaps, to other countries?
Very likely to spread to other countries. I think initially they will focus on Russia, but I think the gravity and the breadth of these allegations mean it's inevitable that there will be questions raised. There are already questions raised about another a Turkish marathon runner as well, so we're already seeing other allegations pop up, perhaps even into other sports as well. Interpol, as you say, taking up this investigation from alongside French authorities who have already launched an investigation into the former head of the IAAF. And as the author of the WADA report said, these allegations are really on another scale up from the scandals that are engulfing FIFA at the moment. So really dark days for world sports. Sebastian Coe, the new head of the IAAF, has described it as such, but he has pledged to make the sport clean. It remains to be seen whether he can do that.
Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London speaking with International Edition's Ira Melman. More than 1 billion people around the world actively use Facebook on a monthly basis. the number continues to grow. Despite such widespread usage, one particular account opened Monday to widespread attention. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with details. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. It's a big deal when the leader of the free world sets up his own Facebook page. U.S. President Barack Obama is now on Facebook at facebook.com/POTUS. That's POTUS. More than 45,000 people liked this page in the first hour.
The president is a busy man. Did he have any time to write anything on the page yet?
He did. There are milestone updates like when he was born, got married, and sworn in as a president twice, but his actual post is about climate change, or what we can do to stop it, rather. So he began the post with, "Hello, Facebook. I finally got my very own page." Somewhere in the second paragraph, he wrote, "We've got to preserve this beautiful planet of ours for our kids and grandkids, and that means taking serious steps to address climate change once and for all. If we're all in this together, I am confident we can solve this and do right by future generations." The writing is accompanied by a video clip of Mr. Obama delivering a similar message from his White House lawn.
I'm going to have to check out his page. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine the amount of attention his post is getting. What's it like so far?
Well, a lot of famous people are commenting. So Sheryl Sandberg, who is the chief operating officer of Facebook and an influential feminist, wrote the first comment. She wrote, "Welcome to Facebook, President Obama. Excited for you to have your very own page and looking forward to the conversation." About 4,000 people liked that comment. TV anchor Katie Couric also commented. She wrote, "Welcome to Facebook, President Obama."
So, Gee, how many people are liking the page so far?
About 300,000 people so far, but, Ray, we both know that number will increase pretty quickly.
Thanks, G. Our program is also on Facebook at facebook.com/voa.asia. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. After her husband passed away, Serlene Rose began playing music at a local hospital as a way of dealing with her grief. But what started out as therapy for the Washington area resident became something more. The joy of sharing her music with others keeps her coming back each week. VOA's Julie Tabo visited the hospital to feel the healing power of Serlene Rose's music.
Serlene Rose has been playing piano in the lobby of Sibley Hospital in Washington every Friday for 20 years. Sharing her music with others, she says, has been a lifesaver for her.
I lost my husband in 1991, and for 5 years I was really, what should I say, at loose ends. And I started to get very depressed, and I put psychologically, if you help somebody else, you help yourself. And that's how I came to Sibley to play the piano.
Rose has been playing the piano since she was just 6 years old. Mostly self-taught, she only has to hear a piece once to play it. Marianne Monick, director of the volunteer program at Sibley, is thrilled to have Rose at the hospital.
Her piano playing, her musical skills, it brings so much joy to everyone, not only patients, not only family members, but staff.
Laboratory manager Anita Matero stops by regularly to hear Rose play.
This means so much to me.
I'm glad.
I can feel my blood pressure drop. You know, I just go.
Well, I'm glad.
As does patient Sandra Snyder.
When I walked in the front door, I was very nervous, uptight, not happy about having to get up in the morning and come here. And there was Serlene playing the piano with music that relaxed me, made me feel much better about being here at the hospital.
And on days Rose isn't there, she is missed, says Ann Itner, a longtime volunteer.
Everybody loves Serlene. You come in here and they, you know, it's very cheerful music, and she's got quite a following.
Rose says after all these years, she's glad she can still brighten everyone's day.
It makes you feel warm and good inside because you know you have done something worthwhile and you're helping someone else. And I think this is what life is all about.
And she feels that's something her late husband would have been proud of.
Whenever I do something where I'm helping people, I always feel my husband is with me and he's saying, good job.
Hey, thank you.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and the Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan have issued a joint declaration of partnership and cooperation. The five Central Asian countries have committed to deepening ties on several fronts, including lowering barriers to regional trade. They have agreed to improve the business climate in the region to attract foreign direct investment and facilitate entrepreneurship and broaden business and investment contacts among the Central Asian countries and the United States. Protecting the environment through the use of clean energy and green technology is also a priority. In an effort to prevent terrorism, trafficking of weapons of mass destruction, illicit drugs, and human beings, all five nations have agreed to enhance their cooperation on border security. Under the joint declaration, the Central Asian nations have committed to supporting Afghanistan and its development as an independent, peaceful, thriving state, recognizing that the situation in Afghanistan remains an important factor in security and stability for the entire region. They have agreed to contribute to global and regional nonproliferation efforts. This includes abiding by the provisions of the Treaty on a Nuclear Weapons-Free Zone in Central Asia and pursuing entry into force of the treaty's protocol. In order to more fully integrate into the global community, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan have agreed to expand their people-to-people ties and encourage wider educational, cultural, and business exchanges. In a part of the world where ensuring that human rights for all continues to be a problem, it is significant that all five signatories to the Joint Declaration of Partnership and Cooperation have agreed to protect human rights. They further committed to develop democratic institutions and strengthen civil society, and to uphold the United Nations Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Helsinki Final Act. Going forward, the Joint Declaration of Partnership and Cooperation will provide a way to strengthen the economic, political, governance, and security ties that facilitate cooperation between the United States and these five Central Asian countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming.